The kitchen door opens onto a bank of snow. An open door, bright with strip lighting, shows rows and rows of stainless steel. Industrial fridges. The sound of clattering and running water and voices comes from inside. My boots crunch on the thick snow. No one clears a path back here. I pull on the snowflake hat with the red plaits and stick my head round the door looking like a mad Gretel. Three men load an industrial dishwasher. Omar? I ask. They look up. Omar walks forward, drying his hands on a tea towel hanging from his waist. He is between 40 and 50. Tanned, compact, wiry. I need a ride. He looks at his watch. I know, I say. You don't get off till 2 a.m. Can you take me then? Where are you going? I hold up the roll of dollars. Wherever I like. He stares for a moment, then nods and turns back to the huge conveyor belt. It's just like the conveyors at airport security, but with water. Trays get loaded up, pass along the belt through the machine, and out the other side. The steaming china is hauled off and stacked on trolleys ready to go back out. I pull off my coat and stand at the clean end. The men look like I've dropped my pants. What are you doing? I'm not going to wait out there in the cold for an hour. Or, put it another way, I'm not going to wait outside while satellites hunt me like a dog. I feel my muscles ease. The slow, repetitive lifting is like being in the gym, but with more steam. Memories of the cold are fading. They pale beside the longer, darker memories of cold. The dormitory under the eaves. One thin blanket per child. No help and no hope. Only the other faces and the endless silent endurance. At 1:30 a.m., the flow of dirty dishes dries up. The end is in sight. Now the trays are coming in singles. At 1:50 a.m., I slide out into the darkness in case a supervisor is going to turn up for the end of the shift. No one comes except a waiter saying the tips are down because someone has broken something. Omar appears in the lit doorway wearing a coat and pushing a fag between his lips. He leads the way down the path and into the darkness with a jerk of his head. My monkey brain watches him. That instinctive part of me that watched in silent wakefulness all the long night hours in the dormitory. Has the woman in the club set me up? How much were they offering? Serious Russians. That could mean anything. Did she phone ahead? Tell him not to be too eager. Tell him to take me to them. Tell him to hand me over somewhere quiet, out of the resort. Parking is at a premium in the resort, and he leads me through the darkness down the mountain. Finally, we hit a side road with one lonely streetlight, and he stops at a green Renault as old as he is. I smell him in the confined space. Nicotine and tiredness. He turns the heater on, opens the glove compartment, and pulls out an ice scraper. He silently gets out and starts the slow business of clearing the car, the heavy, soft thwump of powder hitting the deck, the scrape of ice against glass. He is waiting for someone to come, my monkey brain says. They are taking longer than he expected. He opens the driver's door and gets in, rubbing his hands. The wipers creak as they break out of their ice pockets. They scratch back and forth, back and forth. He wipes the inside of the windscreen with the back of his sleeve and releases the handbrake. The wheels spin on the powder until their chains grip. He eases his way out of the parking space slower than I can walk. Omar's eyes meet mine in the mirror. Paris, I say. I hold up the roll of dollars. $500. Everything I've got. His eyes go back to the road. We pass the dirty concrete of the lower slopes, past the building with Jake's attic bedroom. The black 4x4 has gone. I breathe out. We turn a corner, and a police barrier blocks the road. A checkpoint. Neon flashes. A black 4x4 waits in the shadows beyond the barrier. Fuck. Omar mutters. I can read his stress levels. He has something to hide. He yanks on the handbrake and a policeman walks over. I pull the Gretel hat over my ears and wind down the window. My stream of angry Russian hits the gendarme in the chest. A verbal prod. French police don't take this kind of shit. Especially not from a woman. He hauls the car door open and jerks his head. My fingers graze the tops of my boots as I step out. Passport? I hand over Ivana's passport with a mutter of Russian. He looks it up and down. He glares at me. Breathe in, breathe out. A figure moves in the shadows by the 4x4. They have my GCHQ photo. All they have to do is come over. The gendarme walks over to him, holding my passport. There is no such thing as a straight copper these days. Firestorm has seen to that. I count to 20, leaning up against the car door. The gendarme walks back. Snow flurries in the headlights. He hands me the passport and jerks his head. I snatch the passport and climb back in the car, leaving a torrent of annoyed Russian hanging in the air. The barrier lifts, and they wave us through. As we pass the 4x4, curious faces turn my way. They are looking for an Englishwoman. My Russian has saved me. Chapter 7. 3 hours in, we pull up outside Lyon for petrol. The windscreen wipers are still working overtime. Omar peers through a porthole the size of his fist. I fold myself out of the car door and stretch in the night air, pulling my arms across my body, pressing them against me. We have left the snow behind, but it's still cold. My breath curls away from me, the air twinkly with tiny snow crystals. 4 more hours to get to Paris. Too late for the first train, but maybe in time for the second. Plenty of time for a 4x4 to catch an antique Renault. When will the tall Russian notice her passport is gone? I picture her as I slid the bag under her legs, her head lolled, her legs splayed. Chances are she will be asleep for a while. Will she have noticed before I am clear of Paris? I pour myself a coffee from the service counter. A French motorway stop. The coffee is good. I consider the baguettes under the curved glass deli counter. Parma ham. It's almost a bacon sandwich. I pick up a canvas bag and a baseball cap from a rotating stand. I've got nothing to put in a bag, but a woman without one is weird. The toilet facilities are like service station toilets everywhere, worse than going in the bushes. Above the cracked sink, the mirror is fogged. I drop the mad Gretel hat in the bin and apply more eyeliner. I head back to the car, cradling the coffee cup between numb fingers. 2 minutes later, we are back on the road. I open my eyes. A wall of glass stares down at me. The main entrance of the Gare du Nord. More cameras per square foot than an airport. The gothic stone arch of the old station is on our left. The sleek glass of the new extension on the right. I pass the roll of dollars between the front seats, pull the baseball cap down over my eyes, and step out onto the Paris pavement. Crowds mill around the main entrance. I turn a sharp right and hug the wall, skirting the cameras. It won't protect me from the central pillar cams, and I turn my face to the wall, hunching my shoulders. I cross to the escalator that leads up to the Eurostar terminal. 10 steps in the open. There is a camera at the top of the escalator. I lean down to do up my boot buckle. 9:48 a.m. A one-way ticket on the 10:17 a.m. to London St. Pancras cost me €150. I get my boarding pass at the same time, remembering not to say thank you as she hands me back my Russian passport. I head for the turnstiles and feed in my boarding pass. I picture the call coming into the police department in Courchevel. Maybe the tall blonde goes in herself. Maybe her hotel concierge calls. Either way, the passport is now in the system. A couple of checks and they can see it is currently in the departure lounge of the Paris Eurostar. I am out in the open. Passport control. The line divides into two and then into two again, in front of the glass booths. Four goldfish bowls, two men and two women. Policemen stand either side against the wall. These are not UK bobbies. They are French military police in body armour and carrying submachine guns. Rumour has it that, thanks to Firestorm, organised crime has the Paris police network sewn up. It is not a theory I want to test. I glance back the way I have come. A long dash to the turnstiles. The queue is moving slowly as the UK defends her borders. I edge to the left and to the left again, trying to skew the male-female probability. I don't want to risk a man looking in my eyes, checking me out. A French kid stands in front of the goldfish bowl, hopping from foot to foot. She grips the ledge and pulls herself up, peering through the narrow gap. The passport woman smiles at her father. She hands back their passports with a comment I can't hear. The father laughs, reluctant to move away from the compliments. Out of the corner of my eye, I see the male border controller coming free. I edge towards the father and daughter, hustling them along with my body language. They move off, stuffing passports in hand luggage, and I post my Russian passport and non-EU card through the slot. The passport lady is smiling, distracted. "Cute," I say, watching the little girl and working my Russian accent. She is still smiling as she folds the passport open and feeds it through her scanner. She looks up at me. Ivana Litvinova. Same colour hair, same sort of age. Otherwise, we are not really alike. "Have a good trip," she says, as she hands me my passport. I'm behind the father and daughter in the queue for the security check. The little girl stares at me over his shoulder. I wink. A grey rabbit slips from a gloved hand. She watches me pick it up. I hide it behind my back. She grins. It's a game. Dad puts her down to focus on collapsing the buggy. It's the size of a shopping trolley. I pile my coat and my bag into a plastic tray. I haul up another tray and put Bunny in it. I hold out my hand.
"I will take her through."
Dad looks up in distraction. He smiles at the Good Samaritan.
"Thank you," he says. "Thank you so much."
The little girl beams at me. Together we head through the arch. Security smile at the sight of us. No one asks a mum to put her boots through the scanner. Airside, space is at a premium, and passengers squash together under the arches of the original station. I head straight through the departure lounge and out the far end to the boarding gates, down the travelator and onto the platform. The train is on final call. Stewardesses in blue and yellow stand ready. I turn left down the platform, looking for coach 15. I find my seat and walk past it looking for another seat. Coach 15 is nearly full, and the nearest empty seat is on the aisle several rows away. The window seat is occupied by a businessman in his 50s. He looks up, scowling in disappointment that he isn't getting a double seat to himself. Then he smiles. The Kiss Me Quick t-shirt has changed his mind. He grips his blazer to his side and shuffles his beige trouser leg over to make more room. I settle myself down, take the baseball cap off, and lay out a little effort to be charming. Half an hour later, I know a lot more about the Channel Tunnel. My travelling companion is not a businessman. He is an enthusiast. It is his 10th trip this month.
He waves his hands as he speaks, his tie flapping.
The tunnel is 31.4 miles long, making it the 11th longest tunnel in the world, he says.
Is that right?
13,000 people were employed building it, and only 8 died!
He laughs like this is a ludicrously small number for such an engineering miracle. Time crawls by. Nobody checks tickets on the Eurostar. You need a boarding pass even to get on. There is a guard on the train, but you don't see him. You don't see him unless there is a problem. We are nearly an hour in when the guard appears at the end of carriage 15. He stands the wrong side of the glass doors, scanning the row numbers on the overhead. His eyes stop at the row where I am booked. They drop down to find the seat empty. He turns away, talking into a walkie-talkie, reporting in. There's no one there. The doors open and he walks down the aisle, swaying with the 180 kilometers per hour speed. He has been told to go and check, to make sure. He pauses fractionally before the empty seat, then he carries on walking to the end of the carriage. Definitely not there. The windows black out as we start our descent. 22 miles under the sea, plus 10 miles as the tunnel heads under the seabed. Cruising speed of 75 miles per hour. 20 minutes out of contact with the outside world. Worst case scenario, they check every passport and ticket on the train. Dover to London, 30 minutes. The Eurostar takes 750 passengers. There is no way they can have time for that. Most likely, the guard is told to do an eyes-on, a walkthrough. They know they are looking for a solo woman traveller. The train starts its ascent.
If you hold your hand over the air vents next to the window just before Ashford, you can feel it cut out, my fellow traveller says, his face shiny pink with the pleasure of sharing. This is where the train switches from the overhead cables to the third rail power.
The grey wastelands of Dover come into view. The enthusiast is holding his hand over the heating grill, nodding and smiling. We pull into Ashford. Did the guard get a message through before we went under? Uniforms walk up the platform. Yes, he did. British Transport Police. They disappear from view.
That's unusual, the enthusiast says. The Eurostar doesn't carry transport police.
I nod, but I am not listening. The third option, the really worst-case scenario. They check every unbooked seat. They know their woman is on the train, and they know she is not in a seat she booked. Ergo, she has sat down somewhere else. 30 minutes to check maybe 50 empty seats? Doable. Extremely doable. Coach 15 is towards the end. Will they start at the front and work backwards, or start at the back? I pull the baseball cap hard over my eyes and watch the door.
One of the 4 original boring pieces of equipment was buried in the tunnel, the enthusiast says.
Faces appear in the gap between the carriages. Black uniforms. The transport police. They stand looking at the screen. They have Ivana's passport photo. The doors ping open. Can't be more than 5 empty seats in this carriage, and I am in one of them. I check my knives down the side of my boots, sliding my fingertips into the soft leather, staring at the floor.
The average depth below sea level is 50 metres, but it does get as deep as 75.
They move up the aisle slowly, handing themselves along on the backs of the chairs, scanning the overhead numbers. 10 rows away, 6 rows away, 3 rows away. They are almost on me.
I always book both seats, the enthusiast says. But I'm glad you sat down.
They walk past. Doors open to the next carriage and close behind them.
What?
I stare at my travelling companion.
You always book two seats?
Yes,
he nods, embarrassed.
I like the space.
I close my eyes in disbelief. What were the chances? My whole body exhales. I grip his suit lapels and kiss him hard, plenty of tongue. Like the French, only better. When I pull away, his eyes are closed and his mouth open.
Chapter 8. At St. Pancras, you walk straight off the train, up the platform and onto the station concourse. We file slowly off the train in the middle of the press of people fumbling with wheelie suitcases. I am back in the UK, back in central London, less than a mile from safety. At the entrance to the concourse, four armed police are standing like a pinch point, an eyes-on check. Fuck. I zip up my jacket and pull the baseball cap low. A man is struggling out of a doorway backwards, dragging a giant buggy behind him. I look up into the face of Grey Bunny. Let me help, I smile. He beams his gratitude.
What a coincidence, he says.
I hoist the kid into my arms. Little hands circle my face, sticky little hands. Grey Bunny bounces on my head. He bounces all the way down the platform and out through the pinch point, the kid laughing and Dad pushing the buggy and pulling a suitcase and smiling at us both.
You look like Elsa, she says.
Great, drawn by Disney.
You can be Anna, I say.
I don't want to be Anna.
That's the spirit. The main concourse of St. Pancras is wall-to-wall cameras. A woman stands staring at us like she can't believe her eyes, the missing piece in this family jigsaw.
Mamo!
The kid screams in my ear. She comes towards us, her smile faltering. I set the kid on her feet. Bye, bunny, I say. The kid clings to my calf like a bobble-hatted barnacle. I remember my last psych profiling. The part where they show you a picture and you say the first thing that comes into your head. I remember willing myself to say the right thing, and the psych profiler turning up the picture of the woman in a pool of blood, where you're meant to say butterfly. Butterfly, I said.
Are you sure?
Yep. I've so got this. Flip went the chart. Kitten. Big eyes. Drop kick. Silence. Drop kick was not right. It was so very far from not right that it earned me a tiny red flag at the bottom of the spreadsheet. 61% of respondents, I learnt afterwards, say cute. 36%, the less articulate, say aw. And 3% say something else. Outliers. The station clocks read 1:45 p.m. Gray's Inn Road straight down to Holborn is the direct route, a 20-minute walk in the spring sunshine. I picture my GCHQ photo under a counter in Courchevel, a French police barrier, British transport police searching a train. I won't be taking the direct route. I duck along platform 15, the final platform on the end before King's Cross, and out at the opposite end. There is no avoiding the Euston Road, a six-lane thoroughfare peppered with surveillance. I cross, head down, and dive into the mass of side streets below King's Cross. An hour of zigzagging brings me within reach of the city. Now all bets are off. The square mile has almost as many cameras as workers. This is where I get to find out how good Simon really is. Ages ago, we made a plan. If I was compromised, if GCHQ was compromised, we would meet in a place only he and I know. Will he have seen a stolen passport report come in? Will he have seen the passport was on the 10:17 a.m. train out of Paris and that border control could find no trace of it? Will he join the dots? A lot of maybes. I skirt St. Bart's, down Snow Hill, and into Paternoster Square. A Starbucks is set into the old cathedral precinct. Glass and chrome meet 1,000 years of religious history. I walk by. Not slowly, not quickly. Exactly long enough to see him sitting there with his messy hair and laptop, eyes lifting hopefully to the door. I carry on walking. Surveillance is just as present here, but the stripy awnings of the eateries that line the square were put up after the cameras. There are blind spots, and multiple exits, and multiple vantage points. I sit down on the steps of the fountain with the rest of the lunchtime crowd. Secretaries chatter, their sandals clattering on the stone steps. I watch the east exit of the square. The exit nearest to GCHQ. Traffic noise from New Change and Ludgate Hill fills the square. Braking taxis, sirens, diesel engines. I turn my attention to Starbucks. Customers come and go, typical occupancy of a table, 8 minutes. As many solo customers as there are couples. There are no groups. Team lunch, and they hang out at the All Bar One on the corner. Simon has a laptop out on the desk in front of him. His hand moves rhythmically across the trackpad, top to bottom, top to bottom. I study his face. Dark-rimmed glasses, floppy fringe, messy hair. My calm, unflappable quartermaster. He looks tired. Actually, he looks awful. I turn back to the east and watch the exit. An hour later, I am sure. All the customers in Starbucks have changed. No one is with him. No one followed him. There are 3 entrances to Starbucks. The main entrance, the one on the side, and the one at the back. I go in the back so he can't see me coming and plonk myself down beside him, stretching my legs out sideways and twisting to get my back to the wall. He looks up and exhales like he has spent a week holding his breath. Close to, I can see his eyes are bloodshot. He has 4 days of stubble. I throw an open packet of sugar at him. God, you look awful. You better not be playing solitaire. He twists the screen. CCTV stills of the Gare du Nord fill the page. Square pictures, 5 to a row, 4 rows on a screen. Thousands of images every minute. A tiny part of the tension inside me eases. Simon, he never lets me fall. How did I do? Sugar hangs off him like fake snow. He brushes at it. Good, he says. The best shot is at the top of the escalator. I wasn't sure. Yeah, you either crouch down or you turn like there's someone behind you. Either way, you can't avoid it. They caught on quick. There were transport police on the train. He nods. They think it's the person they want in connection with the Courchevel terrorist attack. What attack? Apparently, someone blew up a helicopter and half the airstrip. His hand reaches across the table for me as if he can't help himself. He pulls it back to his coffee cup. Where have you been? Are you hurt? Out for a day? Bed for a day? A day getting here? Pain flickers across his face. You'd think he would be pleased. I lean forward. I can hardly bring myself to say the words out loud, as if giving them airtime will jinx it. I met him, Simon. The man himself, the Prince of Darkness. Simon stares. Sugar slides off his shoulder. No way. His whisper is hoarse. Who is he? I sit back, shaking my head. Tall, shaved head. Eastern European, maybe Russian. Hot as hell. Simon rolls his eyes. Between 30 and 40. Young. I pick at the packets of sugar. We have a leak 1 mile wide, I say, wondering if you can have a leak 1 mile wide. My GCHQ mugshot was all over Courchevel. Russians, the police, the Eurostar. I thought they would be watching you once they're onto me. Simon looks around at the coffee drinkers anxiously. We have to get you to control. I crane round. I hate having my back to the door. It's good to see you, I say. Chapter 9. A flicker of relief crosses Control's wrinkled face. A shadow of a sigh, but no more. I close the door quietly behind me. He was old when I was a teenager, and that was a decade ago. He looks at me over his steepled fingers. No hug, then?
Where the hell have you been? Correct me if I'm wrong, but you were on surveillance. Can you remember what that is? Geneva went dark on your watch. Half the Three Valleys have gone up in smoke.
He glares.
At what point did your orders include causing an international incident? It is the same story all over again. You are too hasty, too rash, too overconfident. When will you think before you act?
I met him. The man himself. The boss. The Prince of Darkness. I let this sink in. Control stares. I savour the moment. The first time in 10 years I have got the drop on him.
Who is he?
Funny that Simon asked the exact same question. Somehow they expect to know him. I shake my head. I didn't recognise him. Youngish, Eastern European, ripped. The profilers have always struggled with age. The creation of Firestorm suggests youth. The iron control of the heads of organized crime says not. The head of Yakuza is 73, his Mexican opposite number, 69. Now I have met him, I have no trouble reconciling the two. We were right about one thing. Eastern European. He has to be Russian, I say. Moscow are less than helpful in the struggle against organized crime.
So search. Right now, search until you have a name. We have to have him on file. He is the richest man in the world. By definition, he must be a colossus.
My bollocking is forgotten. Control is already picturing telling the NSA the news.
And when we have him...
Yeah. Control doesn't need to say any more. These days, with facial recognition software, you can kill someone from a mile away. He'll be dead by tea time.
Go through the systems. Pull in everything we have. How long will it take you?
I shrug. 24 hours? 36 with the debrief and medical bullshit. Control considers this.
It makes you a target. Forget the debrief. Check in with medical.
I picture the tall figure with the shaved head. I'm a dead woman walking.
You'll just have to get there first.
Control says briskly. Mutually assured destruction. Every Firestorm contractor on the planet will be after me, from the part-time hobbyists to the five-star Goliaths like Solo, Aveline, and the Guardsman. He glares at me.
Why are you still here?
My hand is on the door handle before he speaks again.
Winter.
I turn.
Eric is gone. It's time to grow up.
Chapter 10. 30 minutes later, I am sitting on the couch in the medical suite, pulling my clothes back on. The doctor has gone. The CAT scan has come back clear. I swear he was disappointed. Simon hands me a new locator. I clip it to the top of my ear. He is so relieved he won't shut up.
I'll set you up next door. We will go through it one by one.
He is proposing to lock me in the detainment suite.
Great.
You can't keep me a secret. Everyone will know I'm back. This is the safest place in GCHQ. We will find the answer here. You don't need to go anywhere. The corridor stretches away with pairs of doors leading off it on either side. Not a lot has changed in 10 years. The TCP smell is just the same. Medical are at the far end, on hand, so to speak. They make me shudder. I can't even be in the same room as Everard, GCHQ's chief medical officer.
I meet a lot of people that make my skin crawl, but no one touches Everard. I open the door to the observation room for Detainment Suite 5. It is just down from the one they brought me to when I was a teenage hacker. The room is a dark box, maybe 6 meters by 4, low polystyrene tiled ceiling. One wall is a window onto the interview room. A thin strip of desk sits under it, workspace for the watchers. Behind it, banks of screens give access to the GCHQ mothership. The air is warm with the smell of bodies. I look around. Let's do this. I'll take a shower when I've found him. I have the most valuable intel on the planet in my head. Simon loads the search. White, Caucasian, male, 30 to 40, Eastern European / Russian. I pull up Slashstorm while I wait. 12 faces stare out at me. They're young. Teenage, 15 to 17 at a guess. A girl with wide brown eyes looks into the camera. There is nothing behind her. Mirrors, or a green screen. The counters scroll. More than 1 million votes already. Breathe. It is not happening again. Not if I can help it. The GCHQ systems identify 12,582 possible matches. I think about the shaved head. Could be military, but not necessarily. I'm sure it's not a recent style decision. I take a gamble and screen for buzz cut or shorter. I have cut the matches by 80%. I focus and start scrolling. A face a second. 3,600 an hour. Simon stands on my shoulder. 2,000 faces in, I get up and stretch. It's counterproductive to push too hard. That's when mistakes get made. Carelessness. I sit back down. I'll get you something to eat. Lock the door behind me. Simon goes out. I get up and bring down the bar. I go back to the screen. The buzz cuts are coming to an end. This proves nothing. I load the rest of the search and refocus. Where are you, Prince of Darkness? It's heavy going. A face every 5 seconds. Some of the shots are crystal clear, some lack focus, some grainy, some overexposed, never two with the same problem. My eyes constantly have to readjust, refocus. They feel like parchment. Overexposed. A vein pulses on my jaw. Simon is back with a loaded tray from the canteen. No bacon. I feed my face with my left hand. My right hand scrolls. Productivity goes up. A face every 2 seconds. By midnight, I have come to the end of the 12,582 possible matches. Simon's hand is on my shoulder. How much sleep did you get last night? I think about the Renault. My face icy on one side and warm on the other. I shrug. 3, 4 hours? Simon nods like it was just what he expected. Your work rate is way down. You need to sleep. I look down at the carpet tiles. Hairy. Grey horsehair. Identical to the security center of the Hotel Grand. I'll curl up here. You can lock me in after I lock the door on my side. Simon thinks about this. That might be okay. He nods. I'll get you a blanket. A few minutes later, he's back, his arms crammed with bedding. I've had way worse. I spent 2 weeks sleeping upright, manacled to a wall once. I push back from the desk, looking at the mound of blankets. Give me a couple of hours. Simon hovers. Lock the door behind me. I pull the bar down and hear the key turning in the lock from the outside. I'm asleep before I hit the floor. Bang, bang, bang. Sleep crusts my eyes. I blink. My ribs ache. I've been lying on my left side. "Raise and Shane," says the voice through the door. I sit up, shaking my head. My spine creaks at the neck. I get to my feet, raise the bar and pull the door open. Simon is standing there, a coffee in one hand, a white paper bag in the other, and a change of clothes under his arm.
What time is it?
I scrub at my eyes with the heel of my palm. 8 o'clock. Simon puts the coffee down carefully.
What? You let me sleep all night.
I sink down into the swivel chair and hold out my hand for the bacon sandwich. Simon shakes his head. Shower, change, breakfast. Grumbling, I follow him out of the room and back down the corridor towards medical. The place is deserted. The strip lighting flickers. Simon shoves a pile of toiletries and clothes at me and pushes me into the shower room. I stretch out my neck, putting my face in the scalding jet. I'm going to open the search up. Every white Caucasian male on our systems. He has to be there. Back in the observation room, I settle down for the long haul. 30 to 40-year-old, white, Caucasian men. Global, I tell Simon. He says nothing but shakes his head at the momentary pause before the results come up. GCHQ has the fastest search capabilities on the planet, although the NSA might argue. Any momentary pause is down to the scale of the search. Simon scrubs the data for files already checked. 94,800 new names. I start scrolling. My work rate is fast. 3 hours in and I'm averaging a face a second. Businessmen, sportsmen, politicians, criminals. The day stretches before me with an ever-shrinking pool of options. I'm closing in. I can feel it. Determination drives me. Lunch comes and goes. There is no clue to time in the artificial light. 6 o'clock in the evening, and my optimism is fading. My work rate has stayed steady all day. 2,000 names, break, get up, stretch and get the blood pumping. Get back to it. Simon moves around behind me, coming and going. I refuse to believe that our kingpin has no footprint, no presence. He is the richest man in the world. If he exists at all, by definition, he must be a giant. Daniel was on the phone, Simon says. Daniel, front of house at the Colony Casino in Mayfair, my second home. He wouldn't phone unless he had a problem. What did you tell him? I told him you're busy. I'm down to the last 100, then the last 10, then the last one. The final face fills the screen. A blond-haired, grey-eyed Russian with a scar along his jawline. I rest my forehead on the desk. The keyboard is warm against my cheek. I've got nothing. I jumped off a mountain for nothing. I blew up Courchevel for nothing. Chapter 11. Simon is leaning against the watcher's ledge, his legs stuck out in front of him, his hands in his pockets. Simon, I say from my faceplant on the desk. What happened in Geneva? You mean apart from it going dark? Nothing. Who do we know that could take down isosceles from a mobile laptop? No one. Simon shrugs again. Max is convinced it's Halo. Max, the GCHQ head of research. Halo, the hacker that dominates the dark web. A memory is rattling around. Dark, flickering light, cannabis. I pin it down. A white-haired philanthropist, peacemaker and all-round good guy. The Trainer Trust. Always first at the scene of any disaster, founding orphanages in war-torn hostile states, raising money from anyone who will listen. A one-man philanthropy powerhouse. John J. Trainer III. Simon's hands come out of his pockets. Oh yeah, makes you wonder who would do something like that. We know who would do something like that. He's exactly the kind of person Firestorm was designed to intimidate. You don't take the whole of Geneva dark for a single hit. Isosceles was down. Overkill. He grins. Like using a sledgehammer to crack a nut. Are you taking the piss? I picture the scene on the mountain. Landing lights, rising steam, flames. The helicopter touched down to pick the hacker up like he was the final man on a bank job. Something happened that night. Who do they figure for the hit? Contractor, obviously. I search up the news reports. John J. Traynor III and his three bodyguards taken out in a Firestorm-style hit at the Hotel Grand in Geneva. Bullets between the eyes. Definitely a pro. Eyewitness accounts mention a man in a baseball cap. One of the news channels is carrying old footage of the Nobel presentation. Mr. and Mrs. John J. Traynor hold hands on the podium, pink with pleasure, the smiling faces of representatives of their children's charities around them. Check the feeds, every cam, the satellites, social media for Geneva that night. Halo, if it was Halo, was in a hurry. He may have missed something. Simon fires up the spare terminal. What am I looking for? A man in a baseball cap. Simon rolls his eyes. Great. Around the Hotel Grand. In the streets, some tourist may have something. I go back to my terminal, and after a few seconds the logo of the Geneva Metropolitan Police Department fills my screen. The system's administrator login gives me access to every file on the network. Pathology, blood work, forensics, personnel, IT. Who is running the John J. Traynor III case? Detective Andreas Goddard. Hello, Andreas. I can see where he lives, where he works, what car he drives, its registration number, what his medical history is. I can see how long he has to retirement, and I can see he is registered to the G-Drive. It's all here. Phone records, bank account details, pages and pages of interviews. The gun that fired the shots belonged to one of the bodyguards and was recovered at the scene. Andreas has been methodical. A straight copper in a bent world. I feel kind of bad I'm hacking him. Not bad enough to trust him. All the street cams were down, Simon says in a defeated voice. All the Grand's own cameras, all the police cams, all the airport cams, even Isosceles. Basically, Geneva went pitch black the night you blew up Courchevel. You blow up one tiny helicopter. You sound like control. It wasn't the whole of Courchevel. I've reached the autopsy files. My neck feels cold. The aircon must be working overtime. This wasn't in the news reports. Simon comes to stand behind my shoulder. Post-mortem photos. Three bodies with buzz cuts and matching bullet holes in their foreheads. The fourth can barely be called a body. It looks like it jumped from the top of a building. It looks like it fell in front of a train. I scan the PATH report. Beaten to death with two heavy metal objects not recovered at the scene, Simon reads over my shoulder. Of course they haven't recovered the heavy objects. I feel like calling the pathologist. That is what a body looks like when it has been beaten with knuckle dusters. I think about a white-haired old guy. A man who inherited wealth and then did his best to give it away, living his life under the shadow of this threat. Simon is back at his terminal, data trawling. Makes you wonder, he says after a while, who would do something like this? You already said that. We know exactly who would do this. But even criminals have limits. His voice is suddenly distracted. I think this might be something. On Facebook. I'll just pretty it up. A distance back shot. Outside the hotel. I stand on Simon's shoulder.
The image depixelates at maximum resolution. My breathing stops. Simon scrubs the white cheek of the selfie taker from the frame. My hand grips the back of Simon's chair. I stare. One shoulder and the back of a tanned neck. Hello, handsome. It's not a contractor, I say. How can you tell? Because it is the man himself. I have spent 36 hours looking for his picture, and here he is on Facebook. Chapter 12. I stare and stare at the tanned neck. It was Halo that took Geneva dark. He's the support team when the Prince of Darkness does wet work. Simon swallows. You mean he carried out the hit himself? He walked into the building. He was there, Simon, in person. And no one knows this but us. You and me. We can't trust anyone with this. If we can get an electronic print of him... I don't need to say any more. An electronic signature can be traced to its source. Let's think about what we know, I say. He comes across from... where? Russia? Simon shrugs helplessly. Okay, so let's just say he comes in from the east. Comes in to make a point, to teach John J. Traynor a lesson. Simon looks skeptical. Maybe he wasn't showing enough respect. Maybe he was refusing to bow to Firestorm. Whatever, he decides to administer a lesson, so he flies in. Simon shakes his head. No need to fly in. Comes in by road, flies out when he's in a hurry. My mouth twists as I concede the logic. He's probably right. It just makes the inbound journey more or less impossible to trace. Okay, so let's work it backwards. I stare at the tanned neck. What did we get from the helicopter? Simon shakes his head. Swiftcopter Augusta 109S hired out of Geneva? Paid for in cash. Courchevel pickup. Pilot still in hospital but remembers nothing. He looks at me a shade accusingly. What about an end destination? It must be on the flight path. They were definitely en route somewhere. Paris. Paris is a big city. They could have been going for any number of reasons, or just passing through. I press my thumbs in my eyes and try to focus on what we actually have. At some point that evening, he was here. I jab the Facebook page on the screen. On his own, outside the Hotel Grand, on the Avenue de Mal, probably with a burner phone. Isosceles was down, but the mobile networks were still up. I'm betting he had a burner with him, initialized that evening and disposed of straight away. We need to find that signal. Millions and millions of electronic handshakes go on between devices and mobile towers every minute. To have any hope of pinning down one anonymous burner signal in all the noise, we need a timestamp and a location. I'm accessing the surveillance feeds for Geneva before I remember everything was down. For a moment, I'm stumped. That's what 10 years of government service does to you. I'm so used to Isosceles and all the other GCHQ tools that I've forgotten how to do it like a normal person. I go back to Facebook and check the upload time. 21:01. Monica uploaded her picture of fun times in Geneva the moment she took it. That gives us a time. Location discovery software is based on assessing signal strength between masts. It collects all the data and triangulates down to give a probable location. It's way more accurate in urban environments with the higher number of base stations. Central Geneva will be looking at picocells with a 200-meter range. With a bit of luck, we might even get a femtocell and narrow it down to 10 meters. This kind of tool is used all the time by the intelligence services to find the location of an individual via his phone. I am proposing to use it to find a phone by locating the individual. A needle in an electronic haystack of needles. How many other electronic signatures were there in Geneva that night? We are going to have to do the mother of all tower data dumps. We need to do this upstairs. The detainment suite doesn't have the range for this kind of data search.
I'll do it, Simon says, standing up fast.
Not you. You don't need to go anywhere. Get some sleep. This will take all night to run. He's out of the room before I can argue. I glare at the closing door.
You don't need to go anywhere.
As soon as we have a rough location, I am going. There is no one else I trust with this.
How long will it take Simon to run the software?
Hours, probably. I pull up Slashstorm. No change. 12 faces. 12 scrolling counters. I check Firestorm again. Nothing. Where is the contract on me? He must know by now that I've survived. Can he see my locator? Can he see me now, holed up in the detainment suite, 24 floors below street level, cowering in a grey cell? If he can see my locator, then he can see me coming. And I will be coming. There is one way to find out if he is watching. I slide cautiously out into the corridor. It's deserted. The strip lighting flickers. Silence from medical. No one is in for interview. I creep down the passage until I hit the stairs. Then I am tearing up them two at a time to the locker room. I peer in. Empty. I haul out a full-length white evening dress, yank off my clothes, and scramble into it. I twist my hair on top of my head and pin it in place. The mirror on the back of the door shows red-rimmed eyes. Out comes the black eyeliner and the lip gloss. 7 minutes after I left the detainment suite, I'm ready to go. I swap to heeled boots and check the knives. They're all there. I belt a holster to my right thigh. Check the chamber. I would like more firepower, but the armory is too much of a risk. There's no chance the armory techs won't tip Simon off, and just the thought of me offering myself as bait would give him a cardiac. I head up the stairs to reception. Everyone at GCHQ uses the lift. Sometimes I think I'm the only one that knows the stairs exist. I stride through reception, out onto the street, and glare around at the nighttime junction. The air is cold on my bare arms. The cameras of the bank junction stare down at me. I rotate a full 360 degrees, arms outstretched, hairs pricking on the back of my neck. Here I am. Come and get me. Come and get me, if you think you're hard enough. Chapter 13. A taxi heads down the junction towards me. I climb into the back, watching the grizzled profile in the driver's seat. The interior is cold. Is this it? This quick? The taxi pulls off as I give the address. 15 minutes later, we stop outside a tall, thin Georgian townhouse. The garden square is dark behind its railings, the clamour of Regent Street far away. I pay the man, and he drives off. I watch him until he is out of sight. A carriage lamp above the door is bright in the dark. Harry's eyes crinkle at the sight of me. I climb the shallow flight towards him and kiss his cheek. Stubble grazes my face. He has stood outside the Colony Club, the oldest and most exclusive of London's gaming establishments, for more than 20 years. He was on duty the night of my 17th birthday, the night I broke the bank. It was Harry who intervened when the general manager discovered my age. I've never had much of a home. This is as close as it gets. I turn and look out at the silent square, my locator a pulsing beacon in the night. There's only one way in to the Colony Club, and that is through the front door. Come and get me. Harry, I rest my hand on his arm. Call me if you see anyone you don't recognize.
His eyebrows cock and he looks down at me fondly.
Are you in trouble, Winter?
I pat his arm reassuringly. Nothing serious. Guy trouble. He nods, touching his earpiece, checking that it's fine.
Daniel will be pleased to see you. He jerks his head towards the interior. Someone's having a crack at the bank.
I remember Daniel trying to get hold of me earlier in the evening. That must have been why. Daniel was the pit boss when I broke the bank. He has never held it against me. A decade later, he is general manager and the most highly paid front of house in London. He lets me come and go as I please. I can catch a card sharp faster than any pro. The fire sparks in the grate, filling the hallway with wood smoke. I hang up my white fur and slip through the velvet drapes into the main salon. The room is full of punters, the sound of dice, the clink of glasses, laughter. I don't waste time getting a drink, but head straight for the control room. A service door stands in the corner covered by wallpaper, a servant's door when this was a private house. The corridor beyond is dingy, faded yellow lino on the floor, scuffed walls. The door at the end opens before I have the chance to go through camera security. The control room is in darkness, except for the glare from the screens. Everyone in the room is crowded around a single terminal.
I can't see it, one of the technicians is saying.
Daniel turns and relief blooms on his face at the sight of me. He pulls me into the center and we watch the end of a hand. The stakes are massive. I take in the tension in the dark room, the fear. How much? Daniel tells me. The bank is going down hard. I lean forward. Who is it? The challenger has his back to me, but he doesn't look familiar.
First timer, Kazakhstani billionaire, arrived in London yesterday.
Name?
Constantine.
I shake my head. It doesn't ring a bell. I study the side profile. Dark, floppy hair, high cheekbones. Cute.
Young for a billionaire. Brother of a billionaire, Daniel amends.
It's all the same to him. The technician gets up and gives me the chair. I sit down and watch the six screens, focusing in on the long fingers as they flick the cards. A dinner jacket. Ideal wear for a card sharp. Why is he in the alcove? High rollers get the private room with double the camera surveillance. Daniel is tense.
We prepped the blue room after the call, but then he just sat down in the alcove.
When did he call?
The major domo called this afternoon. I zoom out on the audience. A neat, dapper little figure stands at the challenger's elbow. Personal servant in every line.
Is that him? Daniel nods. Sounds like a sting. We watch the next six hands in silence. The bank is teetering on the edge. I push back from the screens and cross to the two-way mirror. I lean up against the window, watching the challenger's back, the set of his shoulders.
He's cheating, I say.
Daniel is beside me. How? I shake my head. I don't know. Daniel's face pleads. There is only one real answer to a card sharp. He knows it and I know it. A card counter. What can I say to him? Global organized crime are looking for me? There could be a price on my head? Daniel, I can't go out on the floor at the moment. Guy trouble.
Please, Winter. I'll close the doors. We won't let anyone in. No one is better than you.
I think about my locator. I think about Simon noticing I'm gone. I think about the might of global organized crime. I must be mad. Daniel is out of the door and into the service corridor before I have time to reconsider. The saloon is bright after the dark and it feels like everyone is turning our way. A Chinese woman in silver stares. Conversations pause as we pass. The thick red pile of the carpet pulls at my heels. It seems a vast distance to walk the entire length of the room. We thread our way through the knots of people, Daniel in front. The challenger looks up and smiles, like I've just made his day. I try to picture what he's seeing. A woman in white, full-length evening dress, blonde hair on top of her head. Elegant. The croupier slides discreetly away and I step into her place.
"Hi," he says.
I close my mouth to stop myself gaping. If he was good-looking from behind, he is a whole lot better from the front. I strip the cellophane from 7 new packs of cards, empty the shoe, and load it with the new packs.
"I heard they had a card counter here," he grins. "I thought I might check him out."
"Bring it on." "Not him. Her. How about taking your jacket off?" He stands up slowly and shrugs his jacket over one shoulder, and then the other.
"I thought you'd never ask."
"What?" I watch the sleeves as he pulls his hands out. "Nothing." He sits back down.
"Are we playing cards or are we talking?" someone asks.
The first round, the challenger goes down. The second round, same as the first. It's like he's playing an entirely different game. I smile in satisfaction. He looks at his new cards.
"How is the counting going?"
"I've barely got started." Around us, the crowd mutter, disappointed. Rows of beautiful faces stare, murmuring in hushed voices, faces glistening in the heat from the chandeliers. Elnett and Chanel hang in the air. Sweat and lust and cocaine. Silver sequins glitter. I shake my head to clear it. Fluttering restlessness washes over the crowd, and disappointment. They thought the bank was going down. I deal the third round. 2 aces. The challenger looks up into my eyes, and I feel the pull, like the undertow on a riptide. Attraction. He's messing with my concentration. The cards start to slip in my head. The golden room with its peacock colours flickers. A man with a shaved head laughs behind my eyes. Too many hours of looking at bad guys on screen has got me hot. His chair screeches. He's getting up. He leans forward, cupping my chin. His other hand reaches behind my head and pulls something from the coils of hair. I feel it slide out of the creation on top of my head. The crowd gasps in shock. The Ace of Hearts. He adds it to his pair. The onlookers exhale, laughing, and break into spontaneous applause.
"Halt in play, gentlemen."
Daniel appears magically at my elbow. It's just the excuse he needs.
"Can I buy you a drink?"
The challenger's dark eyes are laughing.
"Absolutely."
I lead the way across the main salon to the private room he was supposed to have. The blue room is lit by firelight. Teal velvet sofas line the walls, bolster cushions in turquoise satin. A small Carrara marble bar stands in the corner. The distinctive colony smell of pledge and lilac lingers. On the card table, new blue paisley packs sit neatly stacked. As he enters, I move smoothly behind him and lock the door. The key turns in the lock like a gunshot. He laughs down at me. Dark hair frames his face.
"Now you've got me here, what are you going to do with me?"
I consider him. Young and cute.
"I am going to eat you all up."
"How old are you?"
22. Just think of the stamina.